I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
History of invention, of finding new words and new selves, of coining phrases that may gather currency in a linguistic marketplace, of singing to the cowherds or to the burlesque theater of self. The mead, the hog meat, the curry, the plums, all are the nourishments of language, the things that have made my foray into history so tempting and so tasty. A nation's language, to recall Mark Twain, is a large matter. Reading Seth Lair's book, it's clear he has a love, a passion for language, which began when he was a child. The book begins in the 7th century with the poet Cædmon and his poem believed to be the earliest surviving poem of the English language. The book ends in America with a chapter on Mark Twain, African-American English, and Lair's thoughts about how English will continue to evolve and reinvent itself. He's the Avalon Foundation Professor in the Humanities at Stanford University, and Seth Lair joins us this morning on Radio Times. Nice to have you with us. Good
morning. Thank you, Marty. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you here. Let me begin where your book begins, which is really your description of being a kid growing up someplace in America and feeling and hearing a street full of languages.
Well,
first of all, where
right.
did you grow up?
Well, I was a child in Brooklyn, New York, in the 50s and early 60s, and it was an immigrant community, and there was Yiddish, there was Russian, there was Cuban Spanish, there was Italian, and some of my earliest memories are really the memories of sounds rather than words.
Different and not sounds. Knowing what these words were.
And not knowing what they were, that's right. And so my sense of growing up, as I think many people did and still do grow up, is in a polyglot world.
Meaning hearing all sorts of familiar, unfamiliar sounds.
That's right.
And maybe not knowing what it all
and
means.
And recognizing, too, that, you know, the ability to communicate is not just linguistic. I mean, my father's grandfather spoke not a word of English, and he only spoke Yiddish. And this man's best friend spoke Italian and not a word of English or a word of Yiddish. But they were best friends, speaking their own languages. So, you know, part of what I grew up with was this recognition that we live in a multilingual world, and also that every sentence, you know, a sentence that began in one language might not necessarily end in that language. So I became fascinated as a person and as a scholar and as a teacher with the way in which language makes us who we are.
So you come from a family of immigrants, of what, first or second generation?
Second generation immigrants. Mm-hmm. You know, the world of Brooklyn at that time was, you know, a closed world. It's completely changed. But what I want to stress is not just the uniqueness of my experience, but how emblematic it is of many people's experiences.
Well, I think you refer to this in your book, and I've always felt that every family creates their own language.
That's
based
right.
on their own personal history, their interactions with each other.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the interesting things about looking at the history of the language is that you're looking at the history of families. One of the things that I like in this book is the way in which we can use letters between families, going back to the 15th century to see how language changes, but also to see how some things never change. A father writes to the mother of his son, exasperated, and he keeps calling the child your son. Because, as we know,
Wait, does that sound familiar?
That's right. When he's bad, he's your son, and when he's good, he's my son. So you can see things like this. You can see language changing and developing privately and publicly.
You've also said that J.R.R. Tolkien was a big influence in you, and of course someone who used language, but also created a world out of this language.
That's right. And one of the things about Tolkien is, well, there are many things. One is, of course, he was a professional philologist. That is, he was a professional historian of English and Old Norse and medieval languages and literatures. But when I got to Oxford as a student in the 1970s, Tolkien had died just about a year before I showed up. And my teachers were his students. And so there was this legacy of Tolkien's scholarship, but also of Tolkien's fantasy.
Hmm.
And he created a world in language. He used Old English, Old Norse, medieval Welsh as part of the world of the Hobbit and the world of the Lord of the Rings. And you get a real sense that a lot of what the Lord of the Rings really is about is it's more linguistic than it is a physical adventure.
Well, and I have to say, reading your book, it's clear. I mean, I don't need to tell you this, but I think sometimes our audience doesn't always understand that English has evolved, obviously, over time. We all
right.
know that. But today we think of it as being influenced by the internet and email and
That's
pop
right.
culture and all the things that I think some parts of the population don't really approve of or even appreciate. But looking at the evolution of English, of the English language, it's always being turned on its head.
It's always been, and the interesting thing is that there are always new media. Print comes in and affects the way in which spelling changes. And so when William Caxton prints Chaucer at the end of the 15th century, Caxton respells Chaucer's writing, which had been written a century before, to make it more modern or more readable. And so when we look at the internet or when we look at email, we're looking at the ways in which people are adapting forms of writing for personal expression.
Is that true for all languages, or even especially true for English?
I think that it's true generally for languages. The things that are unique about English are the way in which English is omnivorous with words.
Omnivorous.
Omnivorous, voracious. There are more words in English. There are loan words. English loves to borrow words, and speakers of English have always loved to coin words. Shakespeare coins about 6,000 new words. Mm. Now, actually, in the case of Shakespeare, it usually occurs by him taking an old word and putting un in front of it. But the thing that's very different about English from, let's say, French or from German or from Italian, there's no national, there never was a national academy of language. There was very little regulation of language. And the words that came in and the expressions that came in always changed through commerce and exploration. So I think it's probably fair to say that historically English has been a more porous language than many of the other European languages.
We also don't have words that we describe as either feminine or masculine, thinking of the French or Romance.
Well, we don't have grammar. I mean, this is an important point. That is, we don't have grammatical gender. So that, you know, we have words like, yes, we have words like author and authoress, but it's the author, the authoress. That is, we don't have changes in the definite article the way that the European languages have. And that was lost by about the year 1400 or so. So grammatically, English is also very different. And in terms of pronunciation and spelling, you know, lots and lots of people say, why don't, you know, people write the way that they speak? Why is English spelling so hard? And one of the things that I try to illustrate in the book is that English spelling is historical. The job of spelling since the 18th century has been to preserve old forms, to preserve in fossilized form, if you like, the poetic history of the language.
Let's have you read actually a poem considered to be what the first written poem that has survived over the ages. That
this is what's called Cædmon's Hymn, and it's believed to have been composed in the 680s, and it comes down to us in manuscripts from about 100 years later or so, but for all intents and purposes, it's the earliest English poem, by which we could say it's the earliest poem in a spoken vernacular in the British Isles that we have. And here it is.
Let's listen.
Nu schulen herjan hef en riches werd, Mertid is mechti and is modgedank. Werk wulder vader, swehi wunder je gwes, eetje drichten or anstelede. He erest shop elde bernum, hebben til hroffa, helig shippen. Tha midden jerd monkenes werd, eetje drichten, after teerde, firum folde, freya almichtig. Now that is in the Northumbrian dialect.
Thank you for that, by the way.
It is in the Northumbrian dialect of Old English. And what it basically means is, now let us praise Heaven Kingdom's guardian, the Creator's might, the thought of his mind, the works of this glory father, how he established each of his wonders at the beginning of time. He shaped for the children of earth heaven as a roof. The Holy Creator did this, and he made the middenyard. That's the middle yard. And that's where Tolkien gets Middle Earth from. Is that middle earth, middle yard between heaven and hell. And so the poem goes on, and it's very repetitive, because it's really just a lot of different words for God and what God does. But what's fascinating about the poem is the way in which the poet Cædmon takes this older pagan Germanic vocabulary and appropriates it for a new Christian world. So he's using old words for pagan gods and for temporal rulers. He's applying them to the Christian God. He's taking mythology like the middle yard and heaven roofed and applying them to the Christian world.
Is there any way to know why he did this? I mean, what was going on at the time that he was writing this and that somehow this survived?
Well, this is an important moment in English history. The conversion of the Britons is something that, you know, begins maybe 100 years earlier, but doesn't really take hold. The purpose of the poem and the purpose of telling the story about the poem, as many historians did, was to convert the English and make it clear to them that they could be Christians in their own language.
Hmm. I heard the word something that approximated the word heaven.
Heaven.
In your reading. I mean,
yes.
I was sort of trying to translate it as you were reading it, just hearing the sound.
Yes. Well, in fact, Old English is not as alien as you think. New is now. Shulam is shall. Heaven riches is the kingdom of heaven, the Reich of heaven. Ward is warden. Mood yathank, you know, the thought of his mood, of his mind. You can see buried in the sounds the origins of our modern English words.
Well, moving ahead, and let's you do have a chapter on Beowulf. I guess we should do some justice to Beowulf.
Oh, of course.
Only because of its importance, and Grendel, of course.
But I love Grendel.
I got a feeling that you love Grendel, who never speaks, right?
Grendel never speaks. Beowulf. And Grendel never speaks. And when we first see Grendel, what the poet calls Segrima Gest, the grim spirit, Grendelhatten. He was called Grendel. Mera Markstapa, say the Morris Hold, Fen and Fasten. Let me say a little bit about Grendel in Old English poetry.
Please
this is alliterative poetry. This is poetry that doesn't rhyme or scan in the sense that we see it. It's poetry that builds itself up by repeating the initial consonant of key words and stressed sentences, stressed positions. So you can hear Fen and Fasten, or you can hear Mera Merkstapa, the walker by the borderlands, the grim guest, Grendel. And that, to me, I think one of the things that attracted me to this kind of poetry when I was a kid was that powerful sonic feel.
And through alliteration.
Through alliteration, and also through these amazing, what are called kennings, these metaphors, you know, that the sea is the road of the whale, or the road of the swan, the eye is the cauldron of tears. These are beautiful images.
And we're about a minute away from our first break, but hearing that Cædmon poem, and then we jump to Beowulf, do you see then the language moving?
You can see
forward.
Changes in pronunciation, changes in dialect, changes in yes. And over time, certainly by the time the Normans show up in 1066, Old English is changing. The thing I want to stress is, you know, the English language was changing even before the Normans came. And after the Normans showed up, people were still speaking Old. It's not as if William the Conqueror showed up in 1066 and all of a sudden people were eating champignon in a beurre blanc sauce.
There were things happening before that.
There were things happening before.
Well, I'll tell you what, a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Seth Lehrer, and he's got a new book. It's called Inventing English, A Portable History of the Language. And he used to teach at Princeton University. He's now the Avalon Foundation Professor in the Humanities at Stanford University, and we invited him to be our guest today on Radio Times to talk about this history of the English language. And the lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the University of Pennsylvania Library, presenting a lecture and book signing open to the public at the Penn Library by Professor Kathleen Hall Jamieson, entitled Unspun, Finding Facts in a World of Disinformation. Jamieson monitors the factual accuracy of major U.S. political players. She will speak today, May 11th at 3 p.m. at the University Library in the center of Penn's campus. 1-800-390-1829.
It's the final day of the May membership drive here at 91FM. Our goal is $385,000 from 4,300 listeners. We will make that goal with your pledge of support at 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. On the final day of these membership drives, there's always a sprint to the finish and always a flurry of phone calls. We appreciate that kind of support, but we only will make that goal with your pledge kinds of support. $60 gets you the Radio Times mug. $50 gets you in as a basic subscriber here at 91 FM. We have phone volunteers who can answer all your questions about how much you want to give. 1-888-345-9499. That's the phone number to call. You probably know this by now. You can also pledge online at whyy.org. Many ways to be a subscriber, many reasons as well. Make sure you make that phone call, make that pledge. Thank you so much. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Well, languages are changed and reinvented over time, and that's certainly true of the English language. And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times with our guest, Seth Lehr, author of a new book called Inventing English, A Portable History of the Language. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. All right, marching through history, we get to the Norman Conquest of 1066, and I guess the beginnings of what is now called Middle English.
That's right.
But what happens through the conquerors that come over to?
Well, a lot of things happen. There's a new French vocabulary. The language of institutions, of high culture, becomes French rather than English. Latin becomes more important in education, in administration and government, and in philosophy. Grammar starts to change, pronunciation changes, and the language really morphs so that by the time of Chaucer, in the end of the 14th century, Old English texts are completely illegible. They're unreadable. And Chaucer sounds very different from Old English. If I can, the opening of the Canterbury Tales.
Please do.
Juan that April, with his shore sought the drought of March, hath pierced to the rota, and bathed every vein in switch liqueur, of which vertu engendred is the fleur. Now, I just love this.
I'm back in 10th grade, as you say.
Back in 10th grade, and what's wonderful about this is the way that Chaucer recognizes that there are new words and old words. He's juxtaposing words from Old English with words of French. A word like engendred, engendered, a word like virtue. These are words from a newer vocabulary that are being juxtaposed against the older monosyllabic words of Old English. Hmm. He talks about how Zephyrus inspires. And this is, as far as we can tell, the first use of the word inspire in English poetry to mean both breathe in, but also to create poetic inspiration.
Mm. Do we also get from Chaucer this notion about words and class?
We do.
And character.
Exactly.
Individual person.
We get, and he does this in many, many ways. He has people from the upper classes speak at times with more French. He has characters in his Reeves tale speak in a northern dialect, which is very, very broad. It's sort of the, you know, 14th century equivalent of really a dialect joke. Hmm. But Chaucer's doing this not just for personal reasons, but for philosophical reasons. Chaucer's recognizing that really England is a trilingual culture. It's English, French, and Latin. That there are regional variations, and that language is a mutable thing. And one of the things that Chaucer expresses in language, which is what all English and American writers really express, is how hard, if not impossible, it is to regulate or chain or control language change.
Is he, though, reflecting then what's going on in his country, or is he taking the language and moving it in a certain direction?
I think he's doing both. He's certainly aware of the, if you like, the politics of language and language change at the time, but he's also, by means of his literary example, irrevocably changing English. And the poets and writers who followed Chaucer recognized his accomplishment. Some thought it was wonderful, and they said that he embellished or ornated the language, and some thought it was terrible. Some thought that he had debased the language by bringing in all of these French terms.
Well, it sounds like a very modern argument over language.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to get to the great vowel shift.
Oh, of
but
course.
Let me get just a couple callers in on the conversation, and we've got Alan, and he joins us from Princeton, New Jersey. Alan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
It's fascinating. I was actually going back to what you were talking about before the break, and I was going to ask about the process of revision in some of these earlier texts.
Mm-hmm.
Is anything known about, like the Cadman hymn, for example, did he need to work work that over lots of times, or was this sort of language and like the beautiful imagery in Beowulf, was that just sort of natural to the common man back in that time?
Yeah, and Cadman goes back to 680.
That's
I don't know
right.
whether can
yeah,
you answer
is anything known about that at all?
Well, it's a great question. Yeah. I think you know the story of Cadman is of course a story of inspiration. He just the angel says to him, "Sing me something," and he sings it. What's interesting is the way that scribes after Cadman changed the language by putting it into different dialects and by altering some of the wording. And in the case of Beowulf, we only have one unique manuscript of the poem. And so we have no evidence for any sort of backstory or back revision. It's possible that the poem in some form circulated in oral form or in other manuscripts. What is interesting is looking, I think, not so much at authorial or poetic revision, but the way in which later scribes and readers rewrite and recast. And one of the sort of great archival points of interest for the history of the English language is precisely the way in which people rewrote and modernized earlier texts.
Alan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. All right, let's get to the great vowel shift. And I don't know, people that are obsessed with the English language, I guess this is an important
the
issue.
Great vowel shift. If you Google the great vowel shift, as I do when I'm, you know, when I have free time, you'll see tens of thousands of sites. And one of the interesting things is that they pretty much all tell the story, the same story, that sometime between about the year 1450 and 1600, the pronunciation of the vowels in English changed. Nobody knows really why, but we can see what happened. And so words like nom became name, beat became bite, mate became meat, whose became house.
And these would be the sort of, as we know them, sort of the long vowels.
These are the long vowels. That's right. And what, you know, there are several consequences to this. One is that we say A-E-I-O-U instead of A-E-E-O-U. And all other European languages have those older vowels because they didn't undergo this. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting question. Mm-hmm. The other is sort of why it happened. And nobody really knows why, but one of the theories that's going around is that what happens is that up until about the middle of the 15th century, French still was the prestige language in England. That the court was in French, that royalty was in French, that high culture was in French. And this begins to disappear. And so the question is this, once you lose your prestige language, what fills that social space? Hmm. And one argument is that what fills that social space is a prestige dialect rather than a different language. And so the changing sounds in English sort of coalesced around a new set of pronunciations that were accepted as an educated social standard. So that by the time of Shakespeare, you have a radically different form of pronunciation from the time of Chaucer. And that form of pronunciation, we know from scholars and teachers of Shakespeare's time, was perceived to be an educated standard.
But when you say a long vowel, you're really using a different part of your mouth to speak. Right?
That's right.
I mean, it's not a subtle change. It really is
no,
a different way.
That's why it's a shift. It really is. It's a physical shift in where your sounds come out of your mouth. And one of the things I like to do in teaching, you know, things like this is to get the students to sort of work with their mouths, to make them realize that language is an embodied thing. I mean, it is a physically produced thing. And to learn to use your mouth in a certain kind of way is to learn to understand how language changes.
So the difference between ah and a.
Ah and a. You can feel where it ah, low back, a, higher and more towards the front, e, very high and towards the front. And then, of course, we have diphthongs, these double sounds, the ah-e and the ow. Can I tell you my favorite diphthong?
I would love to hear your favorite diphthong.
My favorite diphthong.
It seems almost obscene, but yes, go
my
ahead.
Favorite diphthong is the sound in words that we pronounce I and might and thine. And this was the sound that was really from about the late 16th, 17th century as the vowel shift was changing. And these would have been pronounced I, so that the capital I would have been I and might. I might go. And this, to me, is the origin of pirate English. That when you go see Pirates of the Caribbean, I want you and your listeners to recognize that what we think of as pirate English is really English. It's quite actually, specifically, it's East Anglian English of the late 17th century.
And think diphthong.
Think diphthong.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Seth Lehrer, our guest today on Radio Times. We are talking about diphthongs and Old English and his new book. It's called Inventing English, A Portable History of the Language. He teaches at Stanford University. And if you want to give us a call, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. As we're talking about this history of English, do we also see then that speaking and writing begins to come together over time or take divergent paths? Or
well,
do we know the answer to that?
Well, I think what's interesting is the way in which people develop a written standard and they develop a spoken standard, that spelling develops as I mentioned earlier, something apart from speech, and that we can see the debate about the relationship between these two things going back really to the 16th and 17th centuries. Some scholars tried to invent phonetic systems of writing. Isaac Newton, a little known fact about Isaac Newton, he was very interested in English pronunciation, and he tried to develop a phonetic alphabet, as many scholars and intellectuals of his time really did. So, you know, we see a lot of things changing at this time, and we see dictionaries emerging. And one of the great things about the history of the English language is to look in the 17th and 18th century at the great dictionaries like Samuel Johnson, whose dictionary comes out in 1755. Precisely the way in which he tries to record language. He had originally set out to make a dictionary because he thought he could fix and control English, but he realized that was impossible. And so a dictionary records but doesn't set out to fix. But of course, Johnson, like all dictionary makers, by simply recording, set standards.
And does that also underscore this, I guess, this tension between how you speak English and how you should speak English?
Exactly. And one of the things, one of the wonderful things about reading Johnson's dictionary is the way in which he tries to record forms but legislates them. He says wonderful things about words. Sometimes he'll call things a low word. You know, wobble is a low word for him. Or he'll define oats. His definition of oats is a food given to horses in England and humans in Scotland. And so, you know,
that's a loaded definition.
Isn't it? It's loaded. His definition of a lexicographer is a harmless drudge. So the wonderful thing about reading this is the way in which you can see these comments, that you see the personality of a linguist coming in and the personality of a historian of language.
Well, I do want to talk about American English, but I don't want to give Shakespeare short shrift.
Oh.
We mentioned him, but it's, I think, important just to underscore his influence over the language, as you said, inventing something like 6,000 new words.
He's coining 6,000 words, and he's using words in remarkable ways. One of my favorite Shakespearean bits, of course, is, you know, that wonderful moment in Macbeth, when Macbeth is thinking about killing Duncan. If it were done, when 'tis done, then to a well, if it were done quickly. Now, all of these words in that opening, these are Old English words. They're short, they're basic, but then he says, if the assassination, and that's a new word.
Hmm.
It's a word from Middle East. It comes from the word hashish, you know, the hashishins, those who would get high and commit acts of political violence. Shakespeare is using the word assassination, as far as we can tell, for the first time in English, to signal the power, but also to juxtapose this, if you like, powerful polysyllabic word against the older simple term.
Well, and what's so wonderful about Shakespeare is just all the wordplay as well, the playfulness.
And the way in which Shakespeare coins expressions that we think are just old-fashioned folk terms. For example, be-all and end-all. Shakespeare coins that. Bated breath, salad days, what the dickens, my mind's eye. These are Shakespeare, lily-livered. These are Shakespearean coinages. These are not folk idioms.
Well, let's talk a bit about American English. And you begin, we were talking about Johnson and his dictionary, and these were some of his thoughts about American English. And I'm quoting from your book here, "To a man of mere animal life, you can urge no argument against going to America, but a man of intellectual enjoyment will not easily go and immerse himself in his posterity for ages in barbarism." He goes on, "I am willing to love all mankind except an American. Sir, they are a race of convicts and ought to be thankful for anything we allow them short of hanging."
Yes, that's a classic Johnsonian move here. And, you know, what's wonderful about this is, of course, the wit of it all.
Yes.
What's wonderful, too, is the way in which Johnson had a huge impact on American English, because Noah Webster, the maker of the American Dictionary in the 1820s, is deeply indebted to Johnson. Johnson. H.L. Mencken, the great writer on language of the early 20th century, is deeply Johnsonian. And so for all of Johnson's seeming contempt for America, he had a huge impact on the language.
Let me get to David from Chicago to join us this morning on Radio Times. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
I wondered, I don't know if you call these urban myths or academic myths, but I've heard two of them. One, that what we currently think of as a southern U.S. dialect or accent is a frozen image of what English, how English was spoken in England at the time that people first emigrated to this continent. And the second is that what we know now as the Queen's English in England actually started out as a caricature and caught on and became much more widespread. Just curious about that.
Me too. Now, David, thanks for the call.
Well,
yeah,
thank
go
you.
Ahead.
Good questions. Sure. It sure, is true that there are pockets of rural or regional American English that preserve older patterns of speech, pronunciation, and grammar. I don't think it's true that Southern English across the board is, let's say, Elizabethan English. Mm-hmm. But it is true that there are certain there are some very famous examples of this. For example, there's a story, I think it's Dizzy Dean, the great baseball player who became a commentator, who is calling a game and says he slud into third. And this is actually an old form of the verb, so it's not a question of a grammatical incorrectness, it's an archaism. The words, for example, line and join would have rhymed in the 18th century as line and jine, and there are certain pockets of American English in Kentucky and the Piedmont that preserve this. So it is true that there are bits and pieces of archaism, but it's an overstatement to say that there's a whole swath of America that's speaking in an old-fashioned way. Queen's English is an interesting question because, you know, what we think of when we think of modern Queen's English is we really think of a controlled form of received pronunciation that really is settled in the early 20th century. There are certain forms of standard British English which in fact are affectations or inventions. For example, the long low A, the aw, so like saying father. This is a stage pronunciation that was developed by the actor David Garrick in the 18th century. And it caught on. So there are some aspects of modern spoken British English that, if you like, are ahistorical. And there are some forms of modern spoken British English that, in fact, are not Queen's English at all, and what people now call estuary English or Blair English is very, very different from that BBC reserved received pronunciation.
Is there something, though, and David, thanks for the call to Radio Times, is there something, though, that when English comes to America, that it begins to change? I mean, is there something about America that changes English?
You know that's, what I mean? That's a great question because that's what the Americans thought. You know, that there really is a sense in reading early American writers like Witherspoon, like Webster, and others, or reading visitors to America, that there was something about the American experience that changed language. Something about, it was believed, the frontier, or something about contact with Native Americans. Something about the experience that really did change it.
Is there an answer to that, or this is maybe this isn't the way?
Well, I think there are many answers. I mean, some answers are, for example, how certain words from Native American culture come in. The earliest words coming into the British, the earliest words coming into English from Native American languages are a canoe and raccoon, moccasin. You know, sort of words for items that they would not have seen or animals that they would not have seen. But there is also, by the time of the Revolution, a belief that America had become, in the words of Washington Irving, a logocracy, that is, a nation of words. And Webster, in particular, is very clear that in America, words mean different things, words like Congress and Senate, annex and admit. These are his examples. So because of the ideologies of politics and democracy, it's believed that American English is in some sense more democratic. Whether that's true or not, I don't know.
Well, I want to pick up on that, talk more about American English with our guest, Seth Lehrer. His book is called Inventing English, A Portable History of the Language, published by Columbia University Press, and he's a professor at Stanford University, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Nashira, the Jewish Chorale of Greater Philadelphia, supports WHYY, presenting their third annual concert, Sing Hallelujah, Sunday, May 20th, 3 p.m. at Congregation Rodef Shalom, 615 North Broad Street. Nashira features its signature variety of settings and styles, from Psalms to Swing, Baroque to Broadway. Nashira's Sing Hallelujah, Sunday, May 20th, 3 p.m. Tickets at tix.com or 1-888-901-6274.
We're in the final hours of the May membership drive here at 91FM. But tonight we hope to raise $385,000 from 4,300 listeners. If you have not had a chance for whatever reason to make a pledge of support to 91FM, why not do it now and make sure that we do make this goal? It's very important that we make the goal because the money gets invested in the programs that you listen to here on 91FM. It's a very simple transaction and a very important one as well. Here's that phone number, and it's 1-888-345-9499. You make that phone call, someone will pick it up at the other end, get you signed up as a subscriber, perhaps new to 91FM, perhaps you're renewing your membership, perhaps you want to rejoin, or even make an additional gift. Also, pledge online at whyy.org. We will know by tonight if we have made that goal. We, of course, will make it with your pledge of support. So do make the call, make it count. Thank you so much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Seth Lehrer on the show today. He's the Avalon Foundation Professor in the Humanities at Stanford University, and he's the author of a new book that we're talking about today on the show called Inventing English, A Portable History of the Language. Calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. Well, as we're charging through, 1,500 years of history here, but we should talk a bit about Mark Twain. You spent a chapter on him, and it's important, I guess, just to underscore his linguistic innovations, which you really credit him for.
You know, Twain said that he never coined any new words. But what Twain did was he took words from public language, from popular culture, from the Civil War, from the media, and he brought them into literary fiction. And my two favorite Twain words, of course, are hello and dude, both of which he uses for the first time in Connecticut Yankee. That hello
had not been used before then.
That hello is just emerging in the 1880s as the word that, you know, you picked up the telephone and said hello. And the popularity of hello is credited to Edison. In fact, Alexander Graham Bell, to the day he died in 1924, I think, answered the phone by saying, ahoy there. So Twain talks about hello. He talks about the operators as hello girls, hello central. But he also uses the word dude, that when Hank Morgan goes back in time to King Arthur's court, the Arthurian knights are iron dudes. And the dude also, like hello, was one of these 1880s words that is new, it's popular, and nobody knows quite where it comes from. But Twain really, he ensconces it in American language.
Well, you hear dude today.
And hello, dude,
and
all
hello
the time.
Exactly, pulling these all together. Well, so how do you think of then American English today? What are all the interesting forces and pressures on the language today?
Oh, there are many different things. I think, first of all, there's contact with other languages. There's the relationship between English and Spanish. There are relationships between English regional dialects and class dialects. The power of African-American English for 2.5 centuries has had an immense impact on American spoken and written English. There's email, the internet, popular culture and advertising, jazz, rap, hip-hop.
And it all happens so quickly, doesn't it? Because we're all so connected to each other.
That's right.
Whatever changes happen.
And I also think it happens through war. The Civil War, the First World War, Second World War, Vietnam, and the Iraq War have all brought people together from different regional and social groups. They learn each other's languages, and they bring back forms into everyday speech or formal writing that had not been admitted before. And I think if there's anything really that's changed American English radically, it's been things like World War II, which changed, you know, really pronunciation, forms of idiom, certain kinds of vocabulary, and the literature that came out of World War II.
Is it too early to hear the words of the Iraq War, that they might be changing English?
I think that it's not too early to hear the, if you like, the lilt of the Iraq War, especially when you read Anthony Swofford's Jarhead.
Oh, yeah.
And I have a little bit on Anthony Swofford where it's clear that, you know, what he's doing in Jarhead is he's not only giving you the sense of what language is like in the military, he's really giving you the sense of how this experience experience debases or makes possible the use of expletive in an everyday sense. Mm-hmm. He also makes clear the way in which there are certain phrases or certain lilts that are military. And the oorah sound, to my mind, is the one, if you like, it's the, you know, it's the equivalent of the what of Beowulf. It's the sound of our time.
Let me get back to our callers, and we've got Tony from Princeton, New Jersey, joining us. Tony, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to ask your guest about his favorite diphthong. Is that the same sound that we hear in Cockney English in London? And also, is it the same sound we hear in the accent of Australians?
Well, those three, I'm glad you brought that up, because the so-called pirate English or Cockney or Australian are forms of speech that develop at different times in different places, but they're all distinguished by unique ways of pronouncing diphthongs. And in fact, in Australian English, you could even argue that there is a triphthong, that is, not just day, that double sound, but die.
Oh.
You know, that is that that you have this sort of sense that what you're looking at in certain forms of Australian English is the legacy of certain region, social class, and idiom of the late 18th century that, once it's physically removed from England, can develop or morph, if you like, on its own.
Tony, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me get to Deborah from Wilmington to join us. Hi, Deborah. Go ahead.
Hi.
You're on the air. Hi there.
I want to go back to the spelling and the irregularities of spelling in English. I've taught English for 30 years in high school and in college, but it was the training that I took to work with dyslexics that was the most instructive for me. And what I learned was that actually 80% of English spelling is fairly regular, and you can teach that. Most of us intuitively pick that up in school, but students who have trouble with sound-symbol correspondence don't. And they believe that all of spelling is irregular, and it's not. So if you go in this very organized way to present the sounds and present the symbols, they learn it, then they retain it. And the other thing is that your guest is quite right about the physicality. When we work with dyslexics, we have them looking at their mouths, sticking their fingers in their mouths, feeling what's going on, and that helps make permanent that sound symbol correspondence.
Well, that's interesting, Deborah. Yeah, go ahead.
That is a wonderful point. I'm glad you bring that up. And one of the things that I like about what you say is also about sort of learning the mouth and learning the voice. One of the things that I became fascinated by, too, is when that becomes of interest to scholars. And in the book, I reproduce the earliest pictures from the 17th century in language textbooks and works of language, which show they draw people's mouths in particular positions to show how to pronounce certain kinds of sounds. And so I reproduce, from John Wilkins' Essay Towards a Real Character, you know, ah, e, e, ah, ooh. And if we were on television, you'd see the mouth moving around. And he has pictures that do that exactly. So I think that this tradition of teaching pronunciation, of working with children of different abilities, goes back really to the 17th century when people saw sound as embodied in that special way.
Deborah, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But do those pictures also say that there is a correct way of speaking?
That's why the pictures are there.
And that's why the pictures, so that you know exactly where to put that
the
sound.
The purpose of the pictures is to show you whatever regional dialect, whatever class form of speech you had, this is how to make your mouth move to be accepted in society.
Deborah, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. You had mentioned African Americans' contribution to American English, and one of the things you say in this chapter is that there's really no single strain. I mean, that makes intuitive sense, but I wonder if you could flesh that out for us.
Well, when we say the word African American English, we, you know, really use it as an umbrella term. But because African Americans have historically lived in different regions of the country, because there's class stratification, because they came from different points of origin, the languages and forms of speech have really varied both regionally and historically. But the thing that I want to stress is that many scholars have found in African American English a sustained sustained grammar and idiom. This is not a case of standard versus substandard, that there are elements of older Creole, so the language does preserve earlier historical forms. I think that's also fascinating. And that the verbal structure of what many people consider to be forms of African-American speech suggests something about a different way of dealing with tense or a different way of dealing with time. Mm-hmm. The other thing I want to say about African-American language and literature that for me was really a discovery in writing the book was the way in which there are really what I call two strains. There's the biblical, the oratorical, the prophetic strain. It's the strain of the preacher. You see it in Frederick Douglass. You see it in those great scenes in Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. You see it in Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And there's also the speech of popular culture. There's the language of the slave culture. There's jazz. There's hip-hop. There's rap. And so there's these two competing strains, if you like, of formal and popular, of oratorical and of communal, that really contribute together to make contemporary African-American speech and literature so rich.
And seeing rap as part of this tradition, part of this strain?
I really do. I mean, I really feel that, you know, as I say, you know, I'm of a generation that, you know, doesn't really listen to rap or doesn't really, you know, doesn't know it firsthand. But reading it from a scholarly point of view, I found things, I mean, in Tupac Shakur's All Eyes on Me, a line like, "Straight to the depths of hell is where those cowards going." That has to me a biblical, a pulpit feel to it. Mm. That this is not just casual speech. This goes back to like the image in Frederick Douglass's autobiography when he imagines the runaway slaves running through. He says, "The reader can have little idea of the phantoms which would flit before the uneducated mind of the slave. Upon each side was grim death, assuming a variety of horrid shapes." It's Milton. It's the King James Bible. It's part of African-American speech, literature, and life. And I think Tupac is aware of that and picks that up.
Let's get back to our callers, and we've got Jenny from Bryn Mawr joining us this morning on Radio Times. Hi, Jenny. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
A wonderful subject. I'm fascinated. I've spent the last 30 years trying to analyze the subtle differences between American and English, but to refer back to a previous caller talking about isolated little pockets of original English, I was surprised to find on a visit to Tangier and Smith Island in the Chesapeake that really they sound like Wiltshire farmers.
That's interesting.
They have exactly the same burr and lilt, and it seems as if it's absolutely frozen in time there, and I wondered what your guest thought about that.
Well, Jenny, I should say he gave me a thumbs up with your call. Go ahead.
I think that's exactly right. That this is one of those places where you can see, if you like, earlier historical forms, certain forms of pronunciation and grammar really surviving. That's a wonderful example. Mm. And clearly your caller is from part of Britain, I assume. And I love that Wiltshire burr. That's a beautiful way of putting it.
But it is interesting to think about. I mean, it's not as if the Chesapeake area is isolated from the rest of America.
I mean,
it's very much integrated into Maryland and Delaware and
that's right.
The Bay
but
itself.
I think historically, you know, there were pockets of geographical isolation. You know, things that now seem to us to be, porous barriers like rivers, like mountains. You know, certainly at the time of settlements, may have been more constraining. And so there really are places like that. There's places like the Piedmont area. There are certain pockets. There's the speech of North Florida, for example, the Florida Panhandle. These are unique little spots, if you like, of linguistic time.
And I wonder if they're also built around a certain way of life. And I think of the Chesapeake with the sailing and the fishing and the skipjacks.
Right.
And
that's right.
Where
you also have a kind of uniqueness of profession or a kind of, or maybe groups of families that sort of live together over time and, you know, have maintained a social structure.
And that's Seth Lehrer, our guest today on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times.
And thank you, Marty. I am Susan Greenbaum, one of the producers of Radio Times, here with a former producer of Radio Times, and actually one of my bosses, Christine Dempsey. We are here to remind you that this is the last chance you have during this membership drive to become a member during Radio Times. And Christine, we all know that at the end of the day, Marty will say to us, well, how did you guys do at Radio Times? Did you do your job? And we say, yes, Marty, we did. But here's our job today. At this moment, we need to hear from about 45 callers in order to make the ambitious goal we've been given, which is to hear from a total of 100 people during Radio Times today. So to meet that mini goal, we need to hear from 45 folks just like you. Give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. Pledge online at whyy.org, and we'll be counting it down, right, Christine?
Counting away, 1-888-345-9499 or whyy.org. It is 11:55 on a Friday, almost afternoon.
Right.
You know, the week is over. The membership campaign will be over this evening. You want to go out and grab lunch. We understand that, but we're just asking you to take about 90 seconds before you head out the door or shut down your computer to support Radio Times and WHYY. 1-888-345-9499 or WHYY.org. Radio Times is a local program. We'll cover some national issues like in the first hour of the program, but we also carry local issues. We cover them in depth. If you live in the city of Philadelphia and you need to elect a candidate for mayor, where did you find out all the detailed information? Probably on Radio Times. If you value that service, let us know right now with a membership pledge. 1-888-345-9499 or whyy.org.
Christine, I think this morning's show is an example of what Marty does so well, and that is in the first hour, she talked about breaking news, and that is the resignation of Tony Blair, his official announcement as to the date that he would leave office. And in fact, this has significant implications for the United States as well as for international affairs. You know, Marty said to us yesterday morning, all right, Tony Blair is going to announce his resignation today. Let's talk about it tomorrow. And then in the second hour, we shifted to something a little bit more kind of different, a little edgy, and that is the development of the English language with Seth Lair, rather intellectual but important and interesting conversation. That's what Marty does day in and day out. She'll help you explore the most important, crucial issues in terms of current events. And then we sometimes lighten it up a bit in hour two and kind of give you something to think about that you might not have had a chance to think about before. We know you listen day in and day out. Perhaps you listen 5 days a week. Perhaps you only get to tune in 1 or 2 days a week. We hope you'll take a moment in this busy morning to give us a call and let us know, particularly let Marty know that indeed, you count on her day in and day out, that you enjoy her programming, and that you rely on her. Please do give us a call, 1-888-345-9499, whyy.org. We are in the throes of a mini goal here, and in order to make our goal in about 3 more minutes, we'd need to hear from about 30 folks. 1-888-345-9499.
That is extremely doable to get 30 folks in 3 minutes because you're listening. We know that you're listening.
Thank you.
And we'd like you to show your support right now. Time is running out to say, yes, I support Radio Times. Here's the thing, Susan, if you had to pay, you know, you pay magazine subscriptions, you pay for satellite radio, you pay for cable, and you pay for those things because you want certain products, certain programs. So if you had to pay to hear Radio Times, would you? If the answer is yes, consider a membership pledge of $50 or maybe a pledge of $60. That's only $5 a month to hear Radio Times, and you can pick up a Radio Times 20th anniversary mug. 1-888-345-9.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.